Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016. Sudanese journalists are staging a hunger strike in Khartoum.
The journalists always argue that if there is any suspension, it should come from a court of law after listening to the case presented by the government. At this time, the newspaper was closed down by an administrative order.
And communities in Western Bahr al-Ghazal appeal to the international community for help.
On behalf of United WOW Group, we appeal for the international community, especially the human rights. Please try to protect the citizens of South Sudan and especially Western Bahr al-Ghazal WOW. We urge you not to turn a blind eye to the people who are being innocently killed.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A big victory today for the government of South Sudan. The country has been admitted into the East Africa Community. Today's move increased the membership of the common market to 6, with a population of 162 million people. South Sudan has been trying to gain entry into the East African Community ever since it declared independence in 2011. The 17th Ordinary Meeting of Heads of State of East African Community resolved to admit South Sudan into the economic bloc during its meeting today in Arusha. The East African Community Secretariat announced the news on its social media website. A statement from East African Community Headquarters in Arusha before the announcement indicated the issue was topping the agenda of today's meeting. South Sudan now joins Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi in the East African Community. It will be part of the regional integration projects that have been the subject of discussion among the member countries. South Sudan was invited to join the East African Community by the presidents of Kenya and Rwanda. Journalists in Sudan who have been working for the Arabic-speaking Al-Tayar newspaper in Khartoum are on the second day of hunger strike over the closure of the paper for more than 80 days. It's not the first time Sudanese journalists have staged a demonstration to express their anger over the lack of freedom of expression in their country. Osman Margani is the editor of Al-Tayar newspaper, the most widely read daily newspaper in the country. He says hunger strike started Tuesday in the newspaper's headquarters.
The strike started today at 1 p.m., Tuesday, 1st of March. It was one of the three stages Al-Tayar campaigns for a cause defending the freedom of expression in Sudan. It was a peaceful demonstration.
Margani says the newspaper has not published for 80 days since members of the National Security closed the paper's operations in Khartoum.
It has been 80 days since they closed the newspaper. They don't have any reason for them to close. It's because in the Constitution Court, we raised a lawsuit and asked the authorities three times to give the reason why the newspaper closed, but they did not respond.
Sadiq Rizik heads the Sudanese Journalist Union. He says his group has been negotiating with Sudanese authorities to lift the ban on Al-Tayar newspaper.
Since yesterday, we have held many meetings with Sudanese government officials to see how to end this crisis. But up to now, we have not gotten any response. But I think we will reopen the newspaper in the next 2 days.
Fatma Al-Ghazali is a Sudanese journalist and a human rights activist. She says two journalists who were taking part in the hunger strike collapsed today and have been admitted to Khartoum teaching hospitals. Doctors at the hospital say the journalists are getting treatment. VOA fellow Nadia Taha prepared this report here in Washington. Still in Sudan, Sudanese media experts say the government should respect the law and allow Al-Tayar newspaper to reopen and resume its work. Nabil Biagio reports from Khartoum.
Mahjoub Mohamed Saleh, the founder of Al-Ayyam newspaper, one of Sudan's oldest independent newspapers, says the hunger strike is a legitimate protest against the unlawful way the government uses to crack down on newspapers in Sudan.
The whole thing is an expression of rejection for the decision by the government of suspending the publication of this newspaper. The journalists always argue that if there is any suspension, it should come from a court of law after listening to the case presented by the government. At this time, the newspaper was closed down by an administrative order.
The order to close At-Tayar newspaper came directly from the National Intelligence and Security Services. President Omar al-Bashir gave the NISS sweeping powers that allow them to arbitrarily arrest dissidents and confiscate newspapers and other published media that the government doesn't like. Mahjoub says journalists in Sudan want the government
to respect the rule of law and the constitution of the country, which guarantees freedom of expression. If a newspaper trespasses on the law, then it goes to court, and nobody is against that.
Faisal Mohamed Saleh is director of programs at Tayba, a media advocacy and consultancy group in Khartoum. He says Sudanese society in general suffers from government repression, but he says journalists are receiving the harshest treatment for just doing their job.
The Sudanese journalist community has been one of the most struggling sector in the Sudanese society. They have been fighting back repression by the government, repressive laws, pre-censorship, suspension of newspaper, closure of newspaper for the last 15 or 20 years. They have never given up. We have implemented many ways and methods to fight back, including memorandums, gathering in front of Sudanese Human Rights Commission, the Press Council. Even we have tried to gather in front of the palace, presidential palace, when there was a closure of some civil society organizations.
Faisal says going on a hunger strike is a new way for Sudanese journalists to protest government violations. He says it's an effective way because the message has been heard throughout Sudan and by the international community.
This is part of the whole Sudanese dilemma. I think every sector should fight his own fight, but some type of coordination is needed. So we are fighting for freedom of expression and media freedom. We understand that that could not happen without a general political change towards democracy, human rights, and justice in the country.
Around 30 journalists from At-Tayar newspaper and some sympathizers currently protesting the paper's closure, and they say they will not end their hunger strike until the government responds to their demands. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
Still in Khartoum, the Sudanese government says more than 3 million residents in Darfur's five states have registered to vote in the upcoming referendum scheduled to take place next month. Voter registration was completed last week. Residents of Darfur will be choosing either to keep the five states that constitute Darfur today or abolish them and establish one region with an autonomous administration. Nabil Biagio also has that story from Khartoum.
The referendum is part of conditions in the Doha Peace Agreement signed between the government and a coalition of rebel groups under the umbrella of Liberation and Justice Movement in 2011. Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal, who heads the National Information Committee for the referendum in Darfur, says a large number of area residents plan to vote next month.
The total in Darfur about 3,538,000, and the citizens are very much actually welcoming. The referendum, it went out in peace. Nothing had been happened during the period of registrations. The referendum will take place in the specific time in April.
The vote is scheduled to last 3 days, starting on April 11th. Bilal says his government will conduct the Darfur referendum in accordance with the Doha Peace Agreement.
This is our duty to carry the people as we brought them to register. We take them also in a good way to come and vote and to practice whether they are going for a region or for the SS. But generally, I can tell you all the people are actually siding the option of states.
In mid-January, fighting erupted between the government and rebels of the Sudan Liberation Army Abdul Wahid Muhammad Nur faction in the Jebel Marra area, forcing tens of thousands of civilians to flee their homes as government planes bombed suspected rebel camps. Bilal says the government is now in full control of the region and peace prevails.
All Darfur is free of any sort of rebels. They are not actually occupying even a single meter in Darfur. The number of the people now registered is almost 30 or 40% more than those who were registered in 2015 for the general elections. And this is because of the peace in Darfur.
Speaking in Arabic, Khalid Salis Abakar, political secretary of the Darfur-based the New Sudanese Justice and Equality Movement, which he signed the Doha Peace Agreement, says the referendum will not bring any change to the hundreds of thousands of civilians who are displaced due to the violence in Darfur.
This referendum will not help the situation that Darfur is in. It's not a priority right now, and it's almost too late. We don't need a Darfur referendum because there's a bigger dialogue going on in the country, which is the national dialogue. And one of the core issues being discussed is how Sudan, as a totality, should be governed.
The New Sudanese Justice and Equality Movement, along with other rebel groups and political forces in Sudan, have been calling for a regime change in Sudan as part of the solution to the conflict in Darfur, southern Kordofan, and Blue Nile states. However, Abakar says making Darfur an autonomous administration will be good for Sudan and make Darfur a model for the rest of the country.
We want the whole Sudan to return to the system of provinces. Back when we had 6 provinces in Sudan, Khartoum province, and 5 other including Darfur, this would be the best way to govern Sudan. And what we want for Darfur, we want for the whole country.
The government of President Omar al-Bashir set up a federal system in the early 1990s, dividing Darfur into 3 states. Later, Darfur was redivided into 5 states of North Darfur, South Darfur, East Darfur, West Darfur, and Central Darfur. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
Communities from Western Bahr al-Ghazal in the diaspora are calling on the government of South Sudan to protect civilians from errant soldiers who are killing and looting civilian property in Wau State. Juku Elias Wakoson speaks for a social media group, United World. She says the international community has forgotten the people of Wau.
Civilians are being attacked in certain areas of Wau. That's mainly where the 30 people are. In the Falata, the Regitalta, and all that places, armed forces attack civilians.
When you say armed forces, where are these forces coming from?
That's a good question, because there are mixed messages, as I'm telling you. We are not sure who is exactly behind the attack. All that they know are people who are wearing military uniforms who are armed. And also we have officials from the government and non-government who have been arrested and detained. And we have also the deputy governor of Wau, he was also arrested. So the incident in Wau is not a good one at all. And unfortunately, the media and the international community is not bringing that in the news and headlines, although people are dying on a daily basis.
Have you made your concerns known to the authorities that you're not happy with what is happening in Wau?
Absolutely. We, the citizens of Western Bahr al-Ghazal, especially Wau, the ones in the diaspora and also in Sudan, our reaction is very, very diverse. People are angry. We feel injustice. We felt that there is atrocity that's taking place in South Sudan, and especially in Wau, which is a very clear violation of human rights.
What is the next course of action? It sounds like you're not happy. People that we have spoken to are also expressing anger. They are saying the government is not protecting them.
Our community is not as united as we expected it to be. But this is, first of all, bringing us together. The course of action, there has been several meetings that took place in order to raise awareness of the situation in Wau, the killing and the brutality, and how we can protect the people of Western Bahr al-Ghazal. Last weekend, two conferences took place in the U.S. and many more within the Western Bahr al-Ghazal communities. Also, some meeting took place in London last weekend. I initiated a group called United Wow. It's a group on Facebook just for us to come together and serve as a platform to mourn and share our concern and also to have a message of unity and solidarity. That's what we want. We want peace and protection for our people.
People back home would say you sound like you want to do something for them, but they want you to direct your complaints to the government because it's the government that will improve the security situation in South Sudan. Do you agree with that?
That is right. I perfectly agree with this because today in the news, the state government of Wau hosted a meeting, an urgent meeting, asking security forces to protect the civilians, especially at night. So they are aware of things like protection for civilians. And yes, as many have said, many people are writing to the government, to the NGOs, and so on. So many actions have been taking place. This is still fresh, and we are just in the first beginning of what to do and how to do things. I have an appeal, and on behalf of United Wow Group, we appeal for the international committee, especially the human rights. Please try to protect the citizens of South Sudan, and especially Western Bahr al-Ghazal, Wau. We urge you not to turn a blind eye to the people who are being innocently killed. Please, please, please do something.
That's Juku Elias Wakoson, a member of United World, a social media group raising awareness about the human rights violation in South Sudan. She was speaking with me from Channels Island in the United Kingdom this past hour. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at what is happening in Uganda after the presidential elections. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there ever a time when information should be censored?
For public interest. There's no information that is supposed to be restricted because we need information and the public needs information. They need awareness. They need to know what is not known.
I believe there are certain times when information has to be censored when it may lead to misunderstandings and wars and maybe riots.
I think it depends on the situation. If a censoring will bring peace, then we should do it.
Yeah, it will depend on the way you had the information or the way you explained it to someone. If it is a bad information, so you just know the way you are going to explain to that person, the way to understand.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Uganda is headed for a Supreme Court battle over the results of the February 18 presidential poll as tensions there continue to climb. Elizabeth Pollard reports for VOA from Kampala.
Amama Mbabazi's lawyers managed to submit their petition to the Supreme Court Tuesday, just minutes before the deadline. The petition lays out 28 alleged irregularities, including bribery, late arrival of voting materials, inconsistencies with voting cards, and election papers the opposition said were pre-checked and stuffed into boxes. Mbabazi finished a distant third in the February 18th poll. Results showed President Yoweri Museveni winning a fifth term in office with 60% of the vote. Second-place finisher Kizza Besigye was not able to get a petition into the courts by the deadline. His camp says repeated arrest and detention by security forces made it impossible for Besigye to file a challenge. Besigye, Museveni's main challenger for the past 15 years, previously challenged election results in 2001 and 2006. His party says they will speak to Mbabazi's camp about possibly joining Mbabazi's petition. Robert Karunda, a legal expert in Kampala, says that's unlikely to happen.
I don't think, though, that he will, because I think there have been two principal issues with his going to the court. In the first place, after 2006, he decided he'd never go back to that court, as he called it, but also because of the handcuffs. I've spoken to his lawyers, and they've told me, man, the challenges are real in terms of what he can and cannot do. And because of those challenges, he figured it's all worth it.
However, if just one count of Embabazi's petition is ruled in favor, the election can be nullified. This could lead to another election within 30 days. The Supreme Court could also name another winner. Meanwhile, journalists in Uganda are coming under increasing pressure. Twice this week, local television stations have done live broadcasts of police loading journalists into cars and taking them away. Robert Sampala, with the Human Rights Network for Journalism in Uganda, says this trend began before the vote.
Since the campaign season started, we have recorded now over 80 incidents, violations and abuses of media rights and freedoms. This has happened mostly at the hands of security agents, more especially the police, which now works hand in hand with the army. Most of the victims have been journalists that are covering opposition-related activities. Lately, we've now seen a more systematic and cruel crackdown on the journalists, especially those who are covering BSJ in Kasangati. Now we have a total of 17 journalists victimized in about 4 or 5 days.
Police say they are arresting people they deem to be disturbing the peace or inciting violence. However, with most journalists being let go the same day, and most of them without charge, many feel these roundups are a tactic of intimidation. The Supreme Court is expected to hear Embabazi's petition next week. The court will have 30 days to rule. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
And now we have some health news. There is growing evidence that the Zika virus causes neurological disorder that can result in paralysis. Researchers at the Pasteur Institute in Paris say they have found a strong link between Zika and Guillain-Barré syndrome. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports from Washington.
The Lancet Medical Journal reports the findings are based on a Zika outbreak in French Polynesia between October 2013 and April 2014. It was the largest Zika outbreak reported up to that time. Lead author, Professor Arnaud Fontenay, says blood samples of those diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS, were analyzed. He describes the syndrome as an ascending form of paralysis.
It starts with the feet and then goes up on the legs and eventually can reach the muscles that you use for breathing, I mean the respiratory muscles. And in those circumstances, patients have to be moved to intensive care units for receiving proper respiratory assistance. So this is what is making the severity of the Guillain-Barré syndrome.
About 5% of GBS patients die. Fontenay says it's associated with a number of infectious agents.
The most typical one is a bacteria called Campylobacter jejuni, which gives gastroenteritis. And it was estimated that out of 10,000 patients infected with this bacteria, 2 to 5 would eventually develop the Guillain-Barré syndrome. There have been other infectious agents, mainly viruses like influenza. And when it comes to disease transmitted by mosquitoes, dengue and chikungunya have been known to be able to trigger some Guillain-Barré syndrome.
He says the fact that the Zika outbreak was over when studied and isolated to French Polynesia allowed researchers to gather a lot of data about Guillain-Barré syndrome. The Pasteur Institute researcher says there was a 17-fold increase in GBS cases during the Zika outbreak. Fontenay calls that a massive increase.
Then we were able to collect data from the 42 patients who developed Guillain-Barré syndrome in French Polynesia. And we learned from those patients, first of all, that 88% of them had 1 week before starting the neurological symptoms of the Guillain-Barré syndrome, a short disease very typical of Zika disease, like fever, rash, conjunctivitis, joint pain.
Further tests over the following weeks strengthened the link. They showed 100% of those with GBS had been infected with Zika.
So when you put together all this evidence, I mean, on one side, the increase in the number of Guillain-Barré syndrome in the population at the time the Zika outbreak goes on. And in all patients, evidence of a recent infection with Zika, you feel quite comfortable that there is a link between the two.
So, does Zika indeed cause Guillain-Barré syndrome?
I would say the only piece which is missing today is by which mechanism the Zika virus would cause Guillain-Barré syndrome. But if we were able to say, well, this is exactly by this mechanism that the Zika virus is triggering the Guillain-Barré syndrome, then I think we would have completed the story.
He says it's a rare complication, 2 GBS cases per 10,000 Zika cases. Nevertheless, cases can quickly add up, as demonstrated in French Polynesia.
As we showed that 66% of the population had been infected with Zika, you can get to substantial numbers. If two-thirds of your population is infected, even if it's a rare complication, well, you end up with 42 patients who have to be hospitalized in intensive care units.
Vaccine research for Guillain-Barré is underway, but Fontenay says it'll be at least 3 years before one is on the market. The professor of epidemiology has some advice for health officials in Latin America trying to deal with Zika. He says once patients show symptoms of Guillain-Barré syndrome, it may take just 4 days before they need to go to intensive care. It usually takes 1 to 2 weeks. The good news is, once the critical phase is over, those patients recover more quickly than normal. After 3 months, 57% of the patients in French Polynesia were able to walk without assistance. It may take some patients nearly a year. Of course, the second major concern with Zika is growing evidence that it's linked to birth defects known as microcephaly that can result in abnormally small heads in babies and other problems. Research continues to confirm cause and effect. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. South Sudan has been admitted into the East African Community. Today's move boosts the membership of the common market to 6, with a combined population of 162 million people. South Sudan has been trying to gain entry into the East African Community since declaring its independence in 2011. The 17th East African Community Heads of State Summit resolved to admit South Sudan into the economic bloc during its meeting in Arusha, Tanzania. The group secretariat announced on its social media site that South Sudan is a new member of the EAC. South Sudan now joins Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi in the community. It will be part of the regional integration projects that have been the subject of discussion among the member countries. Journalists working for the Arabic-speaking El Tayar newspaper in Khartoum are into the second day of a hunger strike over the closure of the paper for more than 80 days now. This is not the first time Sudanese journalists have staged a demonstration to express their anger over the lack of freedom of the press in their country. Asma Mirghani is the editor of the El Tayar newspaper, the most widely read paper in the country. He says it's been a peaceful demonstration so far. Al-Sadiq Ruzaiki, who heads the Sudanese Journalists Union, says his group has been negotiating with Sudanese authorities to lift the ban on the paper. The Sudanese government says more than 3 million residents on Darfur's 5 states have registered to vote. The upcoming referendum will be held next month. That's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
And that's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Shen Shen by Emmanuel Kembe.
Voice of the innocent blood cries out with heartrending resistance in the heart of the person who killed. If you want peace, work for justice and for the heads of the states and political leaders must not sacrifice the lives of their fellow citizens. Shen Shen. This song tells about the actual war situation in South Sudan.
Shen, shen, shen. Shen, shen, mama. Shen, shen.
We've been listening to Emmanuel Kembe with the song Shen, shen. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.